So Eugene had asked me to give a bit of a different kind of overview of the Brahmaviharas tonight. I believe he's been doing a bit of a series on those, is that right? How many people have been to some of that series or all of it? So almost half of you. Okay, great. So he wanted me to offer a little bit of an overview from a different dimension of the Brahmaviharas, from my own experience with them. And that experience is both with the traditional way it is taught often in the West, with the phrases, but it's also with an older form of how the Brahmaviharas are taught, which is in the very earliest recorded teachings that we have in what are called the suttas of the Pali Canon. In those, the Brahmaviharas are more attitudes that are cultivated in a non-specific way. They're skillful attitudes, and I'll review them for people who might not be familiar with them. They're kindness, or metta, compassion, or karuna, appreciative joy, or empathetic joy, mudita, and equanimity, upekkha. So I'll be talking about those from the perspective of kind of gently cultivating them in our hearts and minds, both on retreat, on the cushion, and in daily life. And if we have time, I'm going to teach you a very, very short chant at the end. It's only four words long. And the words are metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha. It's not very hard. You'll hear me say them a lot of times. So these four qualities, the Brahmaviharas, are things that we can cultivate in a general way without using language, even if we want to. We can cultivate them towards this beautiful planet, for example, in honor of Earth Day. Or we can cultivate them towards our own hearts, our minds, towards the actual experience that is arising in this moment itself. The Brahmaviharas this way can actually become part of mindfulness, part of awareness, part of kind of the texture of experience. I'll give a bit of history about them, and then a story, a myth from the commentaries. The history is that the word Brahmavihara, and Eugene probably mentioned this, is derived from an earlier Indian myth or understanding of the god Brahma. It's a very powerful and important god in Hinduism and the pre-Hindu religion of ancient India in which Buddhism sprang up. Vihara means dwelling place. So the two words together mean to rest or dwell or abide in the sublime aspects or states of the god Brahma. In a Buddhist sense, it doesn't mean that same thing. It means to rest or abide in a sublime state of unselfish kindness, of compassion, of altruistic joy, or equanimity. These qualities are sources of strength. Gil Fronstall writes, "In Buddhist mythology, Brahma is a powerful god. In Buddhist practice, the four Brahmaviharas are associated with strength. To develop them well, we must become strong, even courageous. When developed, the Brahmaviharas become potent forces through which we can protect ourselves and others. They're powerful aids for resolving conflict, promoting healing, and for creating social harmony. As strengths, they contribute to confidence in all areas of life." So this actually relates a little bit to the story I'm going to tell. Are you ready for a story? Okay, good. Once upon a time, in ancient hills of North India, a huge gathering of practitioners came. It was just before the monsoons in ancient India. And there were sanghas, little groups of monks and nuns from all over the region that came to take teachings from the Buddha and his senior disciples. And to each group, to each person, they were sort of gathered together and give them the teaching that worked best for them. After they'd received their instructions, they coalesced into little packs of 100, 200 or more, and went with a very senior disciple off on their way to find a place to shelter for the rains. They couldn't all go together because if you have thousands of practitioners together, they're mendicants and they beg for food, and they would have strained the villages that they went to. So they broke up into posses, right? And this story follows one of those groups. So off they set, and they're going over hill after hill after hill off to the west. And eventually, they crest one hill, and they look down upon this beautiful valley with this towering Himalayan mountain above it. And down in the valley, there's a blue lake, crystal blue quartz lake, the commentaries say, with a beach like a nest or a string of pearls along the side of it. And the beach kind of fades off into this beautiful, shady, green, lush forest. And they could just see on the edge of the forest a spring of fresh water. The commentary describes the water as cool and grateful. Such an interesting description, grateful water. There's a village in the distance, and as the monks, the bhikkhus, go down the path towards this spot, which just looks ideal, right? The villagers come and greet them and enthusiastically say, yes, we're happy to support you and give you all the food you need for the entire rains retreat. And not only that, some of them went into the forest and built little shelters at the bottoms of the trees, because in those days, practitioners sat with their backs against trees. So they had little shelters to protect them from the rain. So the bhikkhus are quite happy about this, and they settle in, and they begin to practice. And things go fine for a day, maybe 2 days. And then they come in contact with another community in the forest. This is a community of beings who were already living up in the branches of the trees. Tree spirits, according to this ancient tale. And the tree spirits were fine with the monks coming in, but then they stayed. And eventually, these beings started wondering, when are these people going to leave our front porches? Why are they just like hanging out here? And they got together and they decided, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll scare them off. So they caused the trees to make strange, looming, weird, creepy shadows. They made funky noises at night. They appeared suddenly, startled the practitioners. And pretty soon, the monks started getting distracted. Pale, weak, losing sleep. And after about a week of this, they gathered together and they compared notes and realized that all of them were experiencing the same thing. So the leader said, to heck with this, or however you say that in ancient Magadha, and gathers the group together and they walk back to Buddha to ask him, please give us another place to stay. This place is haunted, we don't like it. The Buddha considers this and says, actually, no, I want you to go back. But here, I'll give you a practice that'll help. And he gives them the practice of loving kindness, saying, radiate this, offer it to everyone you see and everyone you don't see. So the bhikkhus go back to the forest, they settle back in, and they begin practicing the loving kindness. And sure enough, after 2 or 3 days, the hearts of these tree-dwelling beings start to soften, and they become friendly. And the practitioners and those living in the trees started to support each other. The practitioners would send love and kindness to the spirits, and the spirits would be cooperative and happy and sort of kind in return. Sweeping their front porches and giving them back rubs are two of the things mentioned in the sutta commentaries. According to this story, this harmonious environment was so supportive that it deepened the practitioners' meditation at Rain's retreat so much that they all woke up completely. When the two communities parted, they left as friends. Isn't that sweet?
Yeah.
I like this little myth. I like it in part because it talks about harmony between communities, and it also talks about harmony between communities and nature, both. Nowadays, most people don't think of trees in terms of spirits, but trees do carry the essence of oxygen. And in a sense, they're the world's lungs. And we're nature too. Our sweat, our tears, is the same composition as ocean water. The minerals of the earth flow in our blood and rest in our bones. So when we practitioners, like these ancient monks, send loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity to the world around us, these attitudes can include not just the nature outside, but the nature inside, both. So if you like, keep this in mind as we talk, or as I talk, that we are interlinked with nature, are part of nature, and we're part of any intention that we generate. And if it feels right to you, you can just sit in a simple receptive meditation and let the words wash over you. Or you can hang out and listen. Like this story, a number of ancient Buddhist commentaries suggest that cultivating the four immeasurables has an effect on the world around us. There are four forms of unselfish love. This doesn't have to be a mystical idea, although it is a little bit in these ancient scriptures. Whether or not these practices or intentions directly affect the world, they do directly affect the person doing them. Habitual attitudes, habitual thoughts are carried in our faces, our bodies, our nervous systems and psyches. Attitudes inside tend to change how we move through the world, interact with others, and how others, whether they be the person sitting near us, the person walking by, animals, other drivers, those people respond based on the way we carry ourselves and move through the world. I've found for myself that such attitudes and assumptions also can quite dramatically influence how I receive or metabolize information. Words, actions of others can sound very different depending on the attitude that's here in the heart. Same exact words. A child laughing can be a moment of joy, or it can be a moment of irritation, right? It's about the filter in the heart, not about the outside stimulus, more of the time than we care to think. So, an example, I guess. If you are patient, open, at ease, and the grocery store line is moving really, really slowly, really slowly, you're probably more likely to respond to the people who are causing it to move slowly with kindness, compassion, even maybe curiosity. If you're already in an open space, right? If you're already feeling easeful. Whereas if I'm feeling rushed and irritated, a little bit tense, and the same thing happens, my internal response is likely to be quite different. These internal responses can accumulate. They don't just inform the casual interactions we have. You don't need me to tell you that they can inform our long-term relationships too. Especially our long-term relationship with ourself. Cumulatively, attitudes can shape the people around us, our culture, our very environment, even our society. But mostly what they shape is our hearts. So the four Brahma Viharas are a very healthy, skillful way to cultivate attitudes that develop a depth of practice and an open heart. Each, in its own way, is a heart quality, and it's also an expression of wisdom. It can be cultivated as either one or both. Tanisara Bhikkhu talks about this a little bit in his book. This is the Sublime Attitude, his translation of the four Brahma Viharas. The Sublime Attitudes are the Buddha's primary heart teachings. They're the qualities of heart that motivated the Buddha to find awakening. At the same time, he says, they function as part of the path itself. This means that the wisdom of the Buddha's teachings, its head aspect, has to be understood in terms of these heart qualities. At the same time, these heart qualities have to be understood in terms of the head teachings on how cause and effect in our actions can bring about genuine happiness. Only when head and heart are brought together in this way can the Buddhist path yield its full results. I think of it, I guess, in a slightly different way, though I agree with what he has said. But from my own heart, it seems as if wisdom, when it shines through our hearts, refracts like sunlight does through a massive waterfall or the mist around a massive waterfall. And it breaks into these different colors, the rainbow colors, right? So each one, each tint, each color is a shade of wisdom, but it's also a shade of kindness, of metta. It's compassion, karuna, joy, mudita, and equanimity, upekkha. And like that refracted prism of colors, each of these qualities kind of bleeds into the other one a little bit. Each one contains a little bit of a ghost of the other three. From one perspective, we look and we see white light, emptiness, causes and conditions, wisdom. When that same exact perspective is turned to the world of relationships, it's the Brahma Viharas, the Sublime Attitudes. So these four forms of love were actually really important in ancient India, even before the Buddha was born. They were called the immeasurables, the appamanas. And they're in the earliest texts of the other religions as well. So they were sort of, if you will, common property. And to me that makes sense. They're a common property of humanity. They don't belong to any one religion, any one way of seeing or being. The Buddha, though, cultivated the idea of practicing and cultivating them rather than just holding them up as ideals. That's what distinguishes the Buddhist teachings. So in the Pali Canon, which contains the earliest teachings we have of the Buddha, the immeasurables, the Brahma Viharas, are taught as a way of soaking, suffusing our minds and our experience with these attitudes, just like the mist of that waterfall would soak the plants around the stream and the waterfall. These earliest teachings don't talk about words or phrases necessarily. They're unspecific love, unspecific kindness, unspecific compassion, joy, equanimity. Meaning, there's no particular object of attention. You're just cultivating it, tasting it, if you will. The teachings talk about suffusing, or the word is often pervading, the four quarters of the mind with love, kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And they don't offer a whole lot of detail on how, but there's a couple of images or examples. The really classic analogy is of a strong man blowing a conch shell in the four directions, like a trumpet, right? And the sound just carries and moves through and around everything in its path. Another analogy suggests, well, as this analogy suggests, actually, before I move on to another one, there's a way of cultivating love, compassion, kindness, equanimity, joy, by synchronizing it with the breath. Just like you blow out on the horn, on the end of the out-breath, can cultivate one of these attitudes. Another image, also to do with water, to quietly drop the intention of kindness, compassion, joy, or equanimity into the depths of your heart, the way you would drop a pebble into a deep forest pond, or to allow the moisture of one of these attitudes to soak and suffuse through you. The way water soaks and suffuses, in the suttas it says bath powder, but for us I'd say sponge. Right? Just soaks every part of you. Some people find imagining radiating like a star helpful. There's like all kinds of creative approaches to the practice of unspecific metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha. And all of these images, though, they're in the service of cultivating intentions. They're not about cultivating each of these kinds of attitudes. It's not necessarily about cultivating feeling a certain way. Feelings may arise, but the practices are really about cultivating intentions and increasing the depth, scope, and range of these intentions. They also can increase the depth, scope, and range of skillful attitudes that are already in your heart, already in your mind. They most often happen when we're at ease, relaxed, not trying for anything. So the four quarters of the mind pervaded can be like that conch shell blown, and it can be to the four points, north, south, east, west. Or you can do it a little bit more metaphorically, and this is more something I've come up with. It's not from the old teachings. For me, it's helpful to think of the four quarters of my mind as different parts of the mind that I have access to, or different parts of the heart. There's the beautiful and noble quarter. There's the strong and powerful quarter. There's the uncertain, tenuous, unafraid quarter. And there's the petty, small, contracted, and just plain snarky quarter. Right? Here I'm using quarters like neighborhoods of the mind. And as Annie Lamott says, there are some neighborhoods of the mind you don't want to go into alone. The Brahma Viharas make really good company. One of the beautiful things about practicing open awareness or mindfulness with the attitude of one of these Brahma Viharas is that if you meet the beautiful attitudes in the mind with kindness, appreciation, and equanimity, they grow, they get bigger, they get stronger, they come more often. And if you meet the tough stuff, the really difficult parts, with compassion, acceptance, and equanimity, they wane. So there's a way of incorporating this into the process of mindfulness, awareness itself. This can work in retreat or in daily life. Some people find that on retreat, their ways of cultivating unselfish love happen through fusing awareness with whatever state that is. And I'm going to explain this a little bit. But they basically bringing together mindfulness and what Eugene often calls a heartfulness. It's bringing together the mind and the heart. So, example. On one long silent meditation retreat, I was practicing mindfulness of the mind, or awareness of awareness practice, it's called. And that day, I had to lie down. I think I was having back trouble or something. So the mind was really a little bit kind of just wheeling through what it wanted to wheel through. I'm sure none of you have ever had this experience on meditation, right? And it was just kind of doing its thing. But the mindfulness was strong enough to where I was aware the mind was just doing its thing. And after a while, I started noticing, these thoughts are all of friends, and of family, and of Sangha, and of teachers I appreciate, and, you know, just, it was all kind of good stuff. And the mind got curious and dropped underneath all of these thoughts. And at that moment, awareness met love. And when awareness met love, it was like meeting the ocean current beneath the waves. And the love became the object of attention. And everything else that was happening unfolded in this deep, fierce love of the moment. Right? Beautiful. These kinds of experiences happen on retreat, but they're not restricted to it. They can happen in daily life. They can happen on the cushion in the morning sit. It's a matter of noticing, of cultivating, and of appreciating even these tiny glimmers, because they often don't last very long. It doesn't have to be any big mystical thing, basically. So, who here has ever had such a great day that everyone you meet, you kind of meet with a smile on your face and a sense of friendliness? Yeah? Couple? Few? Many? Okay, great. So, it's sort of like, I think that old, maybe it was a 70s term where you walk around with rose-colored glasses on. That kind of thing. Our mood and attitude tints reality. But I'm also saying something else, which is that meeting our attitude shifts reality. Meeting skillful attitudes in daily life, mine, yours, others, savoring them and appreciating them helps them to grow. If you don't cling to them, they might return more often and come back stronger. Like I said, it's sort of like befriending a shy cat. If you pet it gently, it'll come closer or come back. If you try to grab it, it's out of there. But that's the key I've noticed in my own practice and the practice of my peers in daily life, is noticing and appreciating and savoring what's good, and really just turning towards what isn't with a certain kind of love or acceptance. And if you can't muster love and acceptance, and sometimes it's just not possible, acceptance of the fact that it can't happen helps. They become a form of mindfulness this way, and they provide contrast. For example, if you notice whether or not kindness is present throughout your day, you may begin to notice everything that isn't kindness throughout your day, right? And gradually, this kind of noticing begins to condition the heart, condition the mind, to understand that certain ways of relating to the world are skillful and certain ways aren't. This especially works in noticing Vedana or feeling tone. On the same retreat and since, I noticed pettiness, aversion, of comparing mind, all kinds of clinging and contraction. Turning our minds towards it can result in a certain kind of joy of the seeing of it itself. What is seen can be not pleasant, but the seeing itself becomes a touchstone, a source of wisdom. Sometimes it's not possible to meet where you're at. And then it's just helpful to be kind to where you're at. This can happen, this sort of cultivation of compassion, kindness, equanimity, joy can happen in daily life as well. Here's an example. A friend of mine does chaplaincy work. Actually, we both do chaplaincy work, volunteering. And at the time, we were volunteering at San Francisco General Hospital. And it was after a particularly tough shift. This person had been with tragedy for hours. And they were on their way home. They went to the grocery store. And she walked into Trader Joe's, and what she described was seeing everyone in the store as if they were backlit by compassion. Right? She noticed that the tragedy itself she'd witnessed was very sad, it made her sad, but when she focused on the compassion part, the compassion was powerful. What psychologists call elevation of mood. So there was joy intermingled and strength intermingled. That kind of background shimmer is something that you can find in your attitudes if you look for it. Maybe you're not visual, maybe it'll feel more like a flavor or just a sense in your body, but it's there. It can be fun to try unspecific cultivation of Brahmaviharas outside for this reason. Outside in nature, or even outside like downtown San Francisco, where there's a crowd, or a crowd of people walking. And just allow yourself to kind of absorb whatever energy is there, like your skin absorbs sun, or like leaves photosynthesize, and then radiate back out whatever kind of attitude results. You can allow your mind to sort of pick up on the part that's pleasant and radiate it out. It's beautiful to walk through nature this way. Allow the intentions to waft out like the scent of flowers, flow like the waves of the ocean, change like tone and bird song. The object can even just be all of nature itself. And of course, all of us are nature itself too, right? I'm going to close with just saying this. At their highest reaches, the immeasurables, love, compassion, kindness, joy, equanimity, can break down the barriers between ourselves and other people. There's a saying in the Zen community, to be a person of no rank, to be a person who doesn't need to be above, below, or even equal to anyone else. And there's something about cultivating these qualities that helps us to step back. People find that it can help to step back into a bigger picture where there doesn't need to be comparison, but an appreciation, a deep appreciation for the uniqueness of everyone around them. One way of expressing this big picture perspective is that it's possible to cultivate kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity, from the perspective of increasing these wholesome qualities in the world itself. Not just in people, but in aggregate. More joy in the world is a good thing. More compassion, good thing. That way they operate between us, as well as within us. I think I'll stop there. Thank you for your kind attention. And you can take questions or comments if you have them.
Can you talk a little bit about the how? About, it's easy when my heart is already joyful and light.
Yeah.
And when it's not, how do I, what kind of movement needs to happen, or how do I cultivate, how do I encourage, even if it's just a little bit, even if it's just, okay, I can't go there all the way right now. And can you talk about that a little bit?
It's a great question, thank you. So I can just talk about what helps me, basically, and that is that when the heart's really contracted, or there's fear or anger or whatever, to be gentle with the experience of the fear and anger itself, or whatever's happening, right? When it's just whatever's not available, to turn towards it gently, and it's almost like as if turning towards a small beloved child, right? To have that kind of tenderness. And if that kind of tenderness isn't available, to acknowledge that the wish for it is there. Sometimes that's as close as I can get, is I wish that that tenderness were there. I have the intention for it. And I've heard some people talk about even not having the wish, but having the wish they had the wish. So you can just keep backing yourself out as far as you need to go to get to a point of orienting towards this with something besides total, either being absorbed into it or resistance to it. So that's one thing that I find really helpful. The longer I practice, the more I respect just giving where I'm at space and trusting that it's going to change. So that's another one. A couple of teachers I really respect, including psychologist Lee Lipp, who I know you're familiar with, would talk about soothing yourself in times like that. Just being very gentle and imagining like either the young self or a pet or something like that, and starting to invoke the caring and response side of the heart. And it's not cheating to make your imagination work, especially not in this kind of practice. Anything that brings a sense of that nurturing larger self into play can actually help. That's a fantastic step if you get there. The second one, which is sometimes available, is to shift the perspective from the part that's hurt to the part that's offering the comfort. And that can be transformative. It's like do you guys know what a figure-ground relationship is? Maybe there's some artists here. It's the foreground versus the background of an image. It's that powerful. It's like switching from the foreground to the background. Those magic eyes or things like that where the image changes. Reality changes a little bit when you can shift to the perspective of the one that's offering the compassion. I hope that was helpful. Any other questions? Yeah. Hi, Patrick.
Perfect. I'd like to offer a response to your question, that if you make these things part of your practice all the time, then when things aren't going well, they'll still be part of your practice. But you have to like actively make it part of your practice. For example, doing metta chanting every day. And after a while, it just becomes part of who you are. And then it's a lot easier. So my question was, almost always when people do a general talk on the Brahma Viharas, they talk a little bit about the first three, but equanimity just gets mentioned, but they don't ever talk about what it is. And I noticed that you did the same thing. Could you like talk a little bit about what equanimity is?
Sure, thank you. So maybe one of the reasons a lot of us leave equanimity out is it's a little bit tricky to talk about. One discovery for me in my own practice is that equanimity has a lot in common with calm, with serenity. But it actually isn't either one of those things. It's a lot more. Out of the four attitudes that I described, the four Brahma Viharas, it's the closest to wisdom, and it's also the balancing force for the other three. Equanimity is a sense of okayness with all that is. And it can happen in a very serene way, or it can happen when there is a literal storm around you. It's a sense of acceptance, complete acceptance of outcome, complete acceptance of the moment. That doesn't mean you can't work to change what's happening, but it allows for a certain kind of spaciousness around it. There are two forms of equanimity that are described in the suttas. One is upekkha, which literally means to look over. Picture yourself, so it's a big picture, right? You're on a cliff or on a tall building looking over a vista. The other one I actually find very helpful in daily life, which is, here's a mouthful, tatra majja tata. Majja means middle. And tatra means to stand in the middle of. So it's to stand in the middle of. There's a form of equanimity that happens despite whatever is unfolding. Spaciousness. Perhaps you've experienced it. It's not uncommon, actually, in certain crystal clear moments of daily life, when maybe something either so bad or so just out of your context has happened that your judgments drop away. And just like, oh, this is this. Here it is. That's the second form. Equanimity provides space to metta, karuna, and mudita to keep them from getting unbalanced and overly exuberant or overly exhausted and absorbed. That's helpful. We have just a couple of moments left before we need to close. If there's an urgent question, comment, or complaint, I'm happy to listen to it. Otherwise, I'm going to teach you that four-word chant. You ready?
Yes.
Some of you, I'm sure, have heard this or know it, and if you do, you can sing along with me from the beginning. Otherwise, just pick it up on the second or third time around, and I'll ring the bell when it's time to stop. Metta karuna mudita upekkha. 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 May all beings experience kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity. May all beings be safe and free from suffering, the causes of suffering, and causing suffering. May all beings awaken. May we awaken together.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.